Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Elizabeth Taylor, in her heyday, was something to behold. Grand, gutsy, outsized, and so abundantly beautiful, even in tough roles. Here she is in 1966 with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
I'm loud, and I'm vulgar, and I wear the pants in the house because somebody's got to. But I am not a monster. I'm not!
This week, Elizabeth Taylor died at 79, so what's the iconic female figure in our fantasy realm today? What's the arc of change from Taylor to Streep to Jolie? This hour, On Point, the evolution of the female lead from Elizabeth Taylor to right now. You can join the conversation, take Taylor as the baseline. Where have we come in the women we celebrate and swoon for on screen? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Hartford, Connecticut, is Janine Basinger, Chair of Film Studies and Curator of the Film Archives at Wesleyan University. She's author of The Star Machine and A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women 1930 to 1960. She's currently working on a new book on Hollywood marriages with the working title I Do and I Don't. Janine Basinger, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And joining us from New York City is the great chief film critic for the New York Times, A.O. Scott. Tony Scott, welcome back. Wonderful to have you here today.
Very nice to be here, Tom.
Let's listen to just a little more of that unforgettable voice of Elizabeth Taylor. Here she is, not on the big screen, but just the little one, 1992, her only appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
I've had addictions. I've had weight problems. I've almost died a couple of times. I've been pronounced dead. I've read my own obituaries. They were the best reviews I ever had.
Elizabeth Taylor on Living Large, but here when she was just 19 in that role of the flirty rich girl in the 1951 A Place in the Sun. Here's the scene where she and Montgomery Clift finally kiss, famous kiss. They're whispering, so it's a little hard to hear, but her last words are, "Tell Mama. Tell Mama all. She's 19. And then as the music rises, comes that long, famous kiss.
We'll have such wonderful times together. Just the two of us.
Tell me the happiest person in the world.
The sweet and happiest.
Oh, I can only tell you how much I love you. I can only tell you all.
Tell Mama. Tell Mama all."
And here comes that kiss. A.O. Scott, off goes Elizabeth Taylor this week, and we want to look at what she was and where we've come with women, but just paint the picture of this woman in her prime in the world's consciousness.
Well, it was an extraordinary prime. I mean, her prime probably started when she was 12 years old in National Velvet. But I think that you're right to single out Place in the Sun. That is really the turning point. And she regarded it as the first really serious acting that she'd done on screen. And then after that, she was, as you said, remarkably beautiful. But she also had a kind of warmth and toughness and a sense of humor. She wore her stardom very well. She didn't seem oppressed by it or victimized by it or martyred by it. I mean, as you hear in some of those later television interviews, she always had a very good humored perspective on herself and her stardom. But on screen, she did have that thing that defines what a movie star is, that quality of magnetizing our attention, whatever role she was in, whoever else she was with on screen. And she was very good at playing off her co-star. She didn't hog the spotlight, but nonetheless, that is the face that you want to be looking at on the screen. That is the person who your eyes follow.
What a life. Your colleague Manola Dargis calls her the last movie star, reminds us her consumption of men, booze, jewels, and celebrity itself was an astonishment. Big appetites, big passions, and what a figure. Janine Basinger, you've looked back all the way to the 30s and women on screen, and here we come. Just, around almost 1960, here comes Elizabeth Taylor. Where did she take the female lead, the sort of Hollywood superstar mold, Janine?
Well, she really took it beyond epic into, you know, her life is a saga, both on and off screen. The thing about her is that she broke the mold on stardom by just being epic, both, you know, in her personal life and her private life. One of the big differences is that in the studio system, old days, private lives were controlled and hushed up and shaped more for the public. And by the time you get to 1960, that's no longer happening. So you have her living her life as if it is a movie, you know, in the tabloids for us. So she's living two movies for us, the one that she's playing on the screen and the one she's playing in the newspapers. So she's sort of one of the big beginnings of that ongoing celebrity fame. But her looks and her beauty, you know, there's something there. It's not just how spectacularly beautiful she was. I mean, let's think of Hedy Lamarr, you know.
Sure.
But she didn't have that quality that Elizabeth Taylor had. There was something human and palpable there with her that people kind of felt, both men and women. Why should she appeal to women? Why didn't we want to kill her, you know? I mean, I'm sure some women did want to kill her. But, you know, the thing is, women appreciated her beauty, too, because she had a passion and she was fearless about it. So she infuses the idea of a movie star as not having to be a perfect thing that is only up on the screen. She comes down off the screen and lives her life out without fear and liberates herself from conventional ideas about women, and that's a major difference.
A.L. Scott, Tony Scott, we want to look at the arc of where that leading female figure has gone since Elizabeth Taylor, I guess, to look at that and where we are in our kind of skinnied down female lead. One thing you've got to look at is just the abundance of this woman, and she was so abundantly female in a way that stars just seem to refuse to be anymore. They'll eat celery until they get away from that luscious, opulent, ripe fruit. Our friend Camille Paglia calls her. She says she wields the sexual power that, now this is Paglia, that feminism cannot explain and is trying to destroy, the femme fatale, a kind of womanliness that's now completely impossible to find on the U.S. or U.K. screen, rooted in hormonal reality, the vitality of nature.
Wow.
Take it away, Tony.
How can I top that, or how can I
get your hands around
that
it
without yeah. getting in trouble with the FCC? I don't know, but I think that there's certainly the physical type has changed a lot, and you know, you can, I don't know if you can blame personal trainers or standards of beauty or what, but there is a kind of skinny, sinewy, large-eyed, small-framed norm that you see in a lot of movies now, and she certainly was quite curvy and voluptuous and you know, gorgeous in that kind of a bombshell in that way. But so were a lot of other women in the 50s,
sure.
screen goddesses.
Right.
She
right.
did have, I think, there is that quality of charisma, but also approachability, and a kind of frank, unapologetic, and very good-humored sexuality. So
she was in the hunt, and there was no two
yes.
ways about it. She
yes,
let you
no, she
know.
Would, there's something very, very earthy and hot-blooded. You know, almost more like some of the Italian movie stars of the era, like Gina Lollobrigida mm-hmm. or Sophia Loren. Some of that kind of volcanic, earthy sexuality.
Volcanic has got to be it. Here's a little bit from the 1963 Cleopatra, almost bankrupted 20th Century Fox. Not one of the high points of her acting career, but a movie that turned a lot of heads. Taylor as the powerful, dangerous, emasculating Queen of the Nile on her throne, here withholding her love and sexuality, humiliating her lover, Mark Antony, played by Richard Burton, her other great love.
Without a treaty of alliance with Egypt, you could not hold the territories under your command. True?
Possibly.
Then, Lord Antony, you come before me as a suppliant.
If you choose to regard me as such.
I do. You will therefore assume the position of a suppliant before this throne. You will kneel.
I will what?
On your knees.
assume the position, she tells the great Mark Anthony. What
and
about
who wouldn't?
And who wouldn't? What about the way she wielded female power, female sexual power, Janine?
She was, well, first of all, I like the comparison of, you know, I see Elizabeth Taylor as the fried chicken and the stars of today as the celery stalk. I like her as the fried chicken of female stardom. It's
double crispy.
Good. Yes, right. Absolutely. Well, you know, she was unafraid. And why should she be afraid? She took her power. She learned what it was. And she had learned what it was in the studio system where they made every attempt to tamp it down and say, you don't have it. She came right out into it. And, you know, remember, it's going along with changes in society, you know, the feminist movement, the pill, the sexual freedom. And she brought it right out. So women, the sense of be who you are as a woman, be sexy, be sensuous, don't fear it, follow your bliss, as it were. She embodied that idea. And there was a period of time where there were a lot of roles that brought that out, that women could also be sexual if they felt like it, the same as men. And, you know, it wasn't that we hadn't had skinny women before. Mm-hmm. The 1920s was skinny.
Sure.
You know, so you sort of go skinny, fat, you know. I'm hoping we'll soon be back to fat. but, you know, it's not, these things tend to go in cycles. But she was voluptuous and comfortable with it and made it clear to people she was comfortable with it. And that was a strong message for not only females in the real world, but for the images on screen.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolution of the female lead from the great Elizabeth Taylor to right now with A.O. Scott, chief film critic of the New York Times, and Janine Basinger, author of The Star Machine and A Woman's View. Here's Elizabeth Taylor interview with Barbara Walters talking about that bond with twice husband Richard Burton.
It was almost like everything was too much. We loved each other almost too much. It sounds silly.
No, it doesn't.
But it was so intense that it was almost abnormal.
And here are the two famously in Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Mike Nichols' 1966 of the stage play with Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
George didn't have much push. He wasn't particularly aggressive. In fact, he was sort of a flop, a great big fat flop.
Stop it, Mother.
I hope that was an empty bottle, George. You can't afford to waste good liquor. Not on your salary, not on an associate professor's salary.
There's the passion. It was on and off the screen. Put it up to now. Angelina Jolie here plays Jane in the 05 movie Mr. and Mrs. Smith. She and her husband John, played by Brad Pitt, have a happy marriage until it's revealed they're both undercover assassins working independently of each other. Their missions? Each to kill the other. In this scene, John Pitt infiltrates Jane Jolie's office through an air duct.
I thought I told you not to bother me at the office, honey.
Well, you are still Mrs. Smith.
Well, so are a lot of girls.
Careful, Jane. I can push the button anytime, anywhere, sweetheart.
Baby, you couldn't find the button with both hands and a map.
Last warning. You need to disappear.
No.
Now.
You really expect me to roll over and play dead?
Well, you should be used to it after 5 years of marriage.
Six. And I'm not leaving.
Oh, boy, I don't know where we've come. Baby, you couldn't find the button with both hands and a map. Maybe just not the same. Let's get our callers in here. Southampton, New York. Mustang's calling. Hi, Mustang. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think?
Well, I think one of the local headlines, I believe it was the New York Post, put it best when they identified Ms. Taylor as not just a legend or a superstar, but as a Hollywood goddess. And I think the modern female leads have a lot to live up to if they expect to get anywhere near that appellation. Nowadays, it seems like they have more notoriety in the tabloids than they actually do on with their screen credits. Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, as you just mentioned, they're good actors in their own right, but you hear more about them in the tabloids and everything else. It used to be called gossip. And Rex Reed, Liz Smith, and Rona Barrett were about the only ones really doing it. Now it's celebrity news, and it's its own industry employing thousands and thousands of people.
Mustang, we'll look at exactly that, how the media has changed around the women on the big screen. And I appreciate that call. Let me get one more here from Gallatin, Tennessee. Angela, you're on the air, Angela.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to say that I felt a very, very personal sense of loss when we lost Elizabeth Taylor. I was privileged as a 9-year-old girl living in England to meet her. My father, the late Clive Richardson, who was a very famous composer and pianist, was good friends with Michael Wilding, so that's how this came about. But even at 9 years old, I could look at her and think, oh my goodness, could anything be quite that so beautiful and still be living and talking?
And Angela, what about now? How do you compare Elizabeth Taylor and what she grew into as an actress to what we see as the big prominent actresses today?
It was old school drama. And I don't know quite how to explain this. I studied as an actress, and there is a difference between theater drama and motion picture drama. And she came up pretty much on film, so there was no theatrical background, which probably helped her, strangely enough.
In the world of movies, with that intimate camera shot and all the rest, that's unlike the stage. Angela, thank you very much for your call. All right, let's start to dig in here. I don't know. Tony, have you thought about at all the arc we've seen if you move forward from Taylor? Where do you see the female, sort of iconic female film form, actress, as having migrated? How?
Well, it's a very complex question in a way because so much, you know, changes. It's hard to compare just, you know, one actress with another actress. One thing about movie stars, the reason that they are movie stars is that they're all unique. So there's not, you know, there's one Cary Grant, there's one Elizabeth Taylor, there's one Tom Hanks, there's one Julia Roberts. There's not, and comparisons and equivalences are very hard to make. I think that the other thing, obviously, that has changed, or some of the other things that have changed, is the way that celebrity news, as Mustang was suggesting, is consumed and produced and distributed, and it's become. Certainly, Elizabeth Taylor was a fixture of the tabloids and of the gossip press, and you know, was very open about what she was doing and with whom. But I think that now there's a kind of a tabloidization of the culture on the internet, on television, all over the place that is quite predatory, and that is not only putting up young stars, particularly young female stars, as objects of adoration and worship and envy, but also of a kind of hostility and resentment. And it can be, I think, very, very destructive and very scary. And there's a way in which it you know, young new starlets come up every year and then the next crop is ready. And there's something very brutal and disposable about the way that the culture deals with them.
Janine,
I think it's hard.
I wonder, Janine, in that world, if you could be an Elizabeth Taylor today. I mean, I'm struck looking back at the news clips and the films, just first of all by the directness of her gaze. There's a candor, a kind of frankness, a kind of I'm looking straight at you quality to it that maybe all Americans had more of at that time. But actresses today, the gaze looks more veiled, you know? The sunglasses are on more often. Even when they're not, it's kind of veiled.
Important fact is that she was born into a different system where she was taught that it was safe. The studio would take care of it. They shaped the publicity. They saved her from herself, as it were. And she just went out and didn't feel the same way. Today, remember, a star or has a publicity for a star today is a do-it-yourself kit. You know, they have to hire a publicist, a manager. All of these people work for them. And they pay them. And so no is being heard less by a star. And the recklessness and the mistakes that they might make as they enter this very strange world of celebrity, and they're young and they're inexperienced, they don't have anyone to say no to them. Taylor was taught how to behave and what to do in a system that did control it. So I think for her, there was the sense, I am in control of this, or somebody. It felt safer to her, and she didn't have the fear. And she ultimately became the master of it as a result, whereas today we chew them up and throw them away so fast. It's just a different system. It's a totally different system. One important difference between women stars today and Taylor is well illustrated by your Virginia Woolf, Mr. and Mrs. Smith comparison. Mm-hmm. Today, women who are skinny in order to do it are action figures in a way that they didn't used to be in the past.
Angelina Jolie with a grenade launcher or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's a whole kind of new dimension, although women were, you know, gunslingers or gangsters sometimes in the past. Female action figures are one change that we can see that really sets a model for women that is active, it's thin, it's powerful, it's dominant, and it's dangerous.
Well, that's one way to put it. Looking at Camille Paglia again, she talks about it a different way. She says, I'll put this to you, Tony Scott. Camille says that the standard starvation look is now projected by Hollywood women stars, a skeletal, Pilates-honed, anorexic silhouette, which has nothing to do with females as most of the world understands them. She says there's something almost android about the depictions of women currently being projected by Hollywood. They may be able to sling an assault rifle, but that android thing is certainly there compared to Liz Taylor.
Well, I think you even hear it in the audio of in the dialogue of the two clips that we just heard. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Mr. and Mrs. Smith are different genres, different styles of writing. But if you hear the kind of the temperature of discourse between two members of a couple, it's, you know, at full raging heat. In Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. They're screaming and yelling and throwing things and calling each other names. And you imagine that, you know, that kind of acting out in the living room in front of the guests has some correlative, perhaps, you know, in the bedroom when there are no guests around.
Yeah.
But you listen to what Mr. and Mrs. Smith are doing, and there's coolness, there's irony. There is, you know, the temperature is almost glacial. And I think if you hear the way that men and women talk to each other now on screen, it's much more guarded, much more ironical, in a way less combative. I mean, the sort of the drama of love and sex is kind of missing from a lot of the popular movie genres that we have now.
Yeah, if I may,
and these very beautiful actresses don't express it. You look at Natalie Portman, wonderful actress in The Black Swan, a character whose sexuality is repressed, whose body has been you know whittled down and starved into a skeleton in the service of her art, and it's you know it's a very very different image.
Citing here first your colleague Manuela Dargis, she says of Elizabeth Taylor, in contrast to so many other actresses, she seemed as desiring as desirous. And then once again to Paglia, says talks about how false and manufactured sex has become Hollywood sexuality. She says there is no real eroticism anymore. Janine, what do you say?
Well, you know, the thing is, I see this in my students. You see, there's no issue. If they feel like having sex, they just do. There's no battle. There's no surrender.
Wow.
There isn't it. Well, guys, you know, visit a campus. I mean, you know, look in the bushes. It's like, believe me, it's a different world for them. So the battle of the sexes is kind of a dead issue. They have nothing to fight over. So that's why you get movies where suddenly the battle of the sexes is nuclear. You know, they're picking up weapons to shoot one another because there's no other outlet for it. People forget that everything has shifted very, very much. The morality for young people today. So these films kind of reflect that. The issue of desire, seduction, should we, shouldn't we, is not the same level of conflict and tension and question that it once was. And I think films reflect that. And I see that, you know, all the time.
It's amazing the explosive quality. Somehow sexuality diminished even when there's so much sexuality around. Here's Elizabeth Taylor in 1991 at a news conference. She was talking about how she loved being married. But you could feel even there as she described that seven marriages, eight to if you count twice to Burton. But marriage itself could be that battlefield that's maybe been defused.
I really am the marrying kind. Every time that I got married, I hoped it would be forever. It's like when you make a film, you don't make a film hoping it's going to be a disaster.
Elizabeth Taylor, who said, when the sun comes up, I have morals again. Mike in Nashville, Tennessee. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah, sure. What do you think?
My comment would simply be, I think an amazing example of modern female power portrayed on screen would be Uma Thurman in those Kill Bill movies. She was just as sexy as any woman you've ever seen, but usually when you see a woman in an action movie, you know, there's no, like, body armor. She's wearing, like, a tank top and a shotgun, and she's covered in glycerin. You know, it's like the reverse psychology body armor, like all the areas that need to be protected or not.
Yeah, of course. And it's Hollywood.
And then you put Uma Thurman in, and you know, she's got a samurai sword, and there's that amazing fight in the second movie in the trailer with Daryl Hannah, and, you know, it's, when you think about it, I mean, it's two gorgeous Amazonian women kicking the crap out of each other in a trailer, and somehow that, it just sort of, like, those two movies really changed for me my idea of what I thought a strong female lead in that type of movie should be.
Mike, let us work with that right there. You've already got a lot for us. What was it? Two Amazons kicking the crap out of each other in a trailer, and we've got explosive, I don't know, sexual tension or something else. But the thing is, Janine Elizabeth Taylor, without climbing on the ceiling with bloody samurai swords, brought that same volcanic sexuality. You know, without the actual sort of warlike violence along with it, yet there was all the violence of sexual contest there, heterosexual contest.
She said on film to women, we get our side of this. We don't have to lie down and just be there. We get to fight for what we want. Our sexuality matters. What we feel is there. Stand up and yell or fight or, you know, do what you have to do. You get our side of it is okay. We get our share. And women had talked about getting their share in the workplace or whatever, but she was really talking about sexuality, that women can be voluptuous and enjoy it and not fear it. She's very much, as you said at the beginning, the Earth Mother kind of figure in that regard. She put it right out there.
She'd eventually say, I've been through it all, baby. I am Mother Courage. Eternal Polya, Tony, talks about the world-disordering impact of legendary women like Delilah, Salome, Helen of Troy, Elizabeth Taylor, just standing there in her slip in the doorway.
Well, actually, and that image that you're referring to, that was the movie that was coming to mind as Janine was talking, which is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, which is places the central drama there. I mean, it's certainly you know, veiled and cloaked and closeted, being a movie adaptation, but what you see on screen is frustrated female sexual desire and a woman who wants to be with her husband and her husband won't be with her, and it's powerful and it's poignant and it's comical and absurd and all of these things that Tennessee Williams plays are, but it's very hard to imagine female sexuality being at the center of a drama like that now. And I think one of the things that made a movie star like Elizabeth Taylor possible was that the movies in those days were much more interested in women's lives. They were much more interested in the mass female audience and in also telling stories that dramatize the dilemmas and predicaments of women.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the evolution of the female lead from the great Elizabeth Taylor to right now with A.O. Scott, Tony Scott, chief film critic of the New York Times with us from New York, and Janine Basinger, chair of film studies, curator of the film archives at Wesleyan University, author of The Star Machine, A Woman's View. She joins us today from Hartford, Connecticut. Here's a couple of big ones these days. A couple of the two biggest female leads today, Meryl Streep and Anne Hathaway, back in The Devil Wears Prada. Streep's the thinly veiled parody of Vogue's fashion editor Anna Wintour. Anne Hathaway plays her assistant.
I need 10 or 15 skirts from Calvin Klein.
Okay, what kind of skirts do you
need? Please bore someone else with your questions. And make sure we have Pier 59 at 8 a.m. tomorrow. And remind Jocelyn I need to see a few of those satchels that Mark is doing in the pony. And then tell Simone I'll take Jackie if Maggie isn't available. Did Demarchelier confirm?
Demarchelier?
Did he get him on the phone?
Okay.
Okay, so it's not Virginia Woolf, but there they are. We'll talk about them. Karen in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, I just thought, I've been listening to the conversation, and it's very interesting, but it seems we can't have this conversation without bringing in Christina Hendricks into the mix, and although she's just, well, so far, a TV star.
From Mad Men, the sort of big, voluptuous Mad Men star, yes?
Right, and of course, that is a period piece television show, so it's sort of leaning back to that era.
Mm-hmm.
Yet she's a modern star, and I feel this is only the beginning of her career, and there's so it's refreshing to see a woman that big and voluptuous and powerful on the screen again.
Sort of goddess image back right there. What about it, Janine? Skinny big, you say. Can you see it coming?
We have Queen Latifah, we have,
sure, yeah.
We have Kate Winslet. She's not,
yes.
It's A.O. Scott said, this is a little bit tricky simplifying these things. It's complex.
Mm-hmm.
Each person has to be unique and therefore is different. But it does go in and out of cycles. And I think the popularity of Mad Men the influence of that show has been tremendous. And one of the reasons I think is that women were happy to see in the story female figures that were fuller, and the whole world is making an effort to get away from this skinny thing for health reasons. So, who knows what's going to happen? Nothing stays the same. It's always going to you have to have variety. You have to bring new, and you just wait for the next the next Marilyn Monroe, if such a thing were possible, to be followed by the next Audrey Hepburn. It's always an in and out thing, as far as I can see.
Broadway will dim its lights on the Great White Way tonight in honor of Elizabeth Taylor, and a funny note from her funeral today. She had actually requested, she was infamous for being late to things. She requested that her remains, be 15 minutes late for her own funeral. And I guess they haven't. Lots of comment online here. Zeno says, viewing Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf should be required before getting a marriage license. Annie says, I'm hard-pressed to say what might be considered the next Elizabeth Taylor, but certainly not Angelina Jolie. Not her style. Let's go to Michael in Beaufort, North Carolina. Michael, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. On this kind of theme of things change, but they're always the same,
mm-hmm.
the issue of the Hollywood machine. I actually think that once you get into that machine, whether it was for Elizabeth Taylor or now, you get chewed up, and only if you're strong do you survive it. My favorite movie by her, where she was totally transcendent, I thought, was A Place in the Sun with Monty Clift. And Virginia Woolf is a special movie because of the play and what she and Burton did. That was kind of unique because of where they were in their own lives, I think. It wasn't actually a movie. It was watching these two guys duke it out. So it's sort of an exception. But I think what Hollywood does then, I mean, look at Marilyn Monroe and Judy Garland, and what it does now is the same. The details have changed.
You may be right. The details change. It's all the same. I don't know. And yet it's hard to think of a woman like that. Louisa says on Facebook, she says, the leading lady today is perfect but empty. She says there's a fullness to Taylor as a woman. No name comes to mind that compares today. David in Williamsburg, Virginia. David, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I work in the stunt industry, or I used to quite a bit, and as such, I've worked with a number of stars, and in in the late 1980s, I worked on a film called Poker Alice, which was supposed to be the restart of Elizabeth Taylor's career. It was a made-for-TV movie, which she'd been, you know, out of movies for quite some time. She was trying to get started again. And so anyway, long story short, I will cut to the chase. Part of her contract apparently had it that she had to be given gifts on a daily basis in front of the cast and crew, that all production had to stop and they had to have this ceremony and they would give her diamonds and jewelry.
Sounds like a scene from Cleopatra, David. That's incredible. Palanquin, come forward. Okay.
Well, so and on that particular day that I was working on the set, they chose me to be the one to give the gift to her. And I have to say that, you know, I've worked with a lot of stars. I've seen a lot of very famous people and met, you know, presidents and whatever else. I have never been completely transfixed as I was that day looking into those violet eyes. She was easily the most gorgeous goddess I have ever encountered. It was just superhuman.
That's fantastic, David. Right there, bringing the gifts to the lady. I appreciate your call.
I'm on a contract.
Yes, Janine.
Like that.
You do.
Yeah,
yes.
I do. I'm thinking of that for my next contract. But, you know, I also met Elizabeth Taylor, you know, different times, and mm-hmm. she was spectacularly beautiful. I mean, you sort of thought you were prepared for it, but you weren't when you looked at her. She was spectacularly beautiful.
And in the day when Hollywood stars didn't play that down, she just put it right in your face. Here I am, something spectacular.
She always seemed to live with it comfortably, and that little self-deprecating touch she brought to everything, talking about herself, that reminded everybody that she might be spectacularly beautiful, but she was a human being, was a great survival tool that she perfected.
We've got a lot of names pouring in here online from people thinking about contemporary actresses and comparisons. Amy Adams, Keira Knightley, Kate Blanchett, Julianne Moore, Holly Hunter, Kate Winslet. Joe in Arlington, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Joe.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to sort of offer a devil's advocate view here, if I might.
Okay.
It seems to me that Liz Taylor and Angelina Jolie might actually be sort of on the same end of a spectrum where the pendulum swing the other way is like a Meryl Streep or a Jessica Lange, and the difference being that sort of goddess factor. Like, you know, I see Angelina Jolie and, you know, the breaking up of huge celebrity marriages and staggering beauty and all the things that you guys are sort of touching on, whereas on the other end of the, you know, when the other end of that pendulum swing, you've got Meryl Streep and, you know, who knows who she's married to or what her life is like off camera, because she you know, she acted at a time when the craft was paramount, you know, the acting was paramount and not the sort of lifestyle of the stardom or whatnot. So
yeah,
you know,
exquisite
I
craft,
this
but
sort of a return to glamour.
Well, I mean, you may be right. Tony Scott, think with us about Meryl Streep for a minute. I mean, here she would come well after Elizabeth Taylor's heyday. Nevertheless, it was all with craft and not so much to put herself in your face as to these many astonishing characters that she would create through craft.
Well, right. I think another, I mean, we've been talking about all of the different things that changed. One of the very significant changes is in the approach to the craft of screen acting. So in for Elizabeth Taylor and others of her era, even, you know, even ones who were trained in the Stanislavski method and, mm-hmm. and came out of the traditions of theatrical realism, someone like Marlon Brando or James Dean, or even, you know, Marilyn Monroe, who had some method training, they are always highly individuated, and they're always, you know, you always know that you're watching. There's no question of Elizabeth Taylor ever disappearing into a role, which is exactly what Meryl Streep mm-hmm. Was always famous for doing. So you're forgetting, you know, that you're watching Meryl Streep, but you're actually watching Karen Silkwood or Sophie in Sophie's Choice or mm-hmm. these incredible acts of impersonation, Julia Child, Anna Wintour. I think that Meryl Streep has become, in a way, more playful and more self-conscious in her more recent roles.
Yeah,
so
true.
She's become
yeah.
more of a movie star as she's embraced her comic talents and I think has had some of her biggest successes and has drawn a new generation of fans. But mm-hmm. but I do think that what we want from, and you know, you think even of someone like Nicole Kidman, who is extraordinarily beautiful and glamorous, mm-hmm. and had certainly the makings of a movie star. But you know, she won her Oscar for transforming herself into Virginia Woolf,
right?
Who I guess no one was afraid. It was the
very
the
self.
Of the day. But by putting on a prosthetic nose and, right. And looking kind of, you know, disguising her glamour and beauty, just as Charlize Theron did, another ravishingly beautiful woman to win the Oscar for Monster, just as Hilary Swank yeah. did, sort of being masculine and tough in both Boys Don't Cry and Million Dollar Baby. So the I guess the idea of what an actress does and how they transform themselves into a role has changed a lot. So the idea of great acting is now much more about a kind of self-effacement, going deep, 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 deep into the character.
Let's go to Annie in Clarksville, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Annie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I really had a comment really towards this topic.
Okay, yes.
With although I think Elizabeth Taylor was a great Hollywood actress, I think what has really changed on the baseline is what female audiences today are looking for in a large lead female role.
Okay.
And I think that although what Taylor did was great for her time, and she, you know, she fabulously represented the sexual oppression that women were feeling and expressing their emotions out in the open, I think today younger female audiences, like especially with my group of my age group, we're looking more for, you know, we didn't grow up with that kind of repression.
Right.
So we're not looking for that overtly sexual or overtly emotional kind of temperament. We're looking for, you know, real kind of awkward
life.
Film. People like Ellen Page, for instance. You know, we want somebody who's funny, down to earth, and like us.
And you're the audience, so you'll get what you demand.
Exactly.
Yeah, Annie, I love that. If I may, Janine, there's a web comment along those lines. Well, not exactly, but it's maybe related. Diane writes about, you know, Elizabeth Taylor. She says, for all her powers as an actress, she was perhaps limited, quote unquote, by the fact that she was a sexual creature, impossibly beautiful. Diane writes, I can't help feeling that there's some lament going on here for the cultural transformations of feminism. And that makes her uncomfortable. To cite Pahlia once more, she would say yes. She looks back and says, Taylor wields the sexual power that feminism cannot explain and has tried to destroy. Annie's ready to move beyond all of it.
Well, right. That's what you see in young people today. They're not defining it in the same way. They want something that reflects their own ability to make the choices that they can make. I mean, things have changed for women, maybe not as much as many would like, but they have. And, you know, Taylor is an important part of that transition, though. You know, without a Taylor doing what she did in the period of time she did it, you don't evolve over to where you are today. It was a step on a progression. And I think that what A.O. Scott, I'm not calling you Tony since I don't know you that well, but Tony, if
it's
I
okay,
may.
You can. Tony, you may.
Thank you. Now I'm going to be much more relaxed.
Good.
The thing is that, you know, he said such an important thing when he said, you know, how are you going to cast an Elizabeth Taylor? I mean, she can't be knocking around the old box factory. You know, this is a face
right.
and a person that you have to deal with in a particular way. And with her voluptuous quality, you know, you cast her. It's a visual medium, and there you go with it. But I do think I like very much what that young woman said, because it definitely reflects what I see in the young people that I'm surrounded with.
What, bring us even an awkward actress? That's fine.
Exactly.
Just make it real. Make it pertain.
Make it real. That's right. Well, because that's what we go to the movies for, you know, to see ourselves in some way.
Yeah, and someone, you know, someone. Mm-hmm. A 20-year-old actress now trying to do what Elizabeth Taylor did then would look bizarre
yes.
on screen. And I think that yeah, I mean, there are a lot of wonderful young actresses who I think do reflect. She named Ellen Page. Another one I think is Greta Gerwig,
mm-hmm,
who's
yes.
going to be the
Definitely.
Remake of Arthur, who is also a filmmaker and writer, and is exploring what it is to be a young woman now in very authentic and original and unusual ways. So I think, you know, the history keeps going, and I think when some of these great figures pass from the scene, we're allowed to indulge a little bit of nostalgia, which doesn't mean that we wish things were still the way they used to be.
No, but it maybe does mean that when we look at the arc of female leads, we're really looking at the arc of us all, where the whole show has moved since she was there in the doorway in that Come On Baby slip.
Yeah, and you have to remember that prior to her were gigantic female stars who had vehicles built for them. Excuse me, I'm having a cold.
But me too, I'm sympathetic.
Good, thank you. But they reflected what mature women wanted and wanted to see themselves doing in their concerns appropriate to their own times. People like Davis and Crawford and Stanwyck, they were right for their eras. And it's always this, we have to look ahead. Who will be next? Because we pick them up and we put them down according to how they serve our emotional needs and according to what we can see in them. And that's really what it's always been about when it came to movie stars.
Does that mean sexual passion itself is somewhere behind us, Janine? Can it mean
well,
that?
In my own personal testimony, I'll pass that. But here's the thing. In my students, it's different. It's not that it's not there, but the fear of it, the repression of it has changed. It's not the same for them as it was for me when I was in college.
Maybe it doesn't take a volcano to get it going. maybe not.
Maybe.
Janine Bastinger, it's always so wonderful to have you with us, and I'm
Thanks.
So grateful to
Thank you
for being here today.
Thank you.
Janine Bastinger, author of The Star Machine and A Woman's View, How Hollywood Spoke to Women, 1930 to 1960. And Tony Scott, A.O. Scott, you are the man. We love having you. Thanks for joining us on Elizabeth Taylor and Moore.
Always a pleasure. A lot of fun. Thanks.
Tony Scott, chief film critic with the New York Times. Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.